This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I should say host, but also realtors with Oakwin Realty in downtown Vancouver. And I'm so excited.
Me too, Adam. James Evans, past guest, fan favorite, is back on the show.
James wears a lot of hats.
He wears a lot of hats. It was a long time ago, I feel, that we had James on. But James, he's a great guy, lives in my neighborhood, actually. And very humble, but he's not only a builder, he's done amazing East Van projects primarily, but he's involved in tons. Once you kind of start asking him about what projects he has on the go and which projects he's been responsible for, both heritage conversion and kind of larger multifamily, it's amazing. But then he's also the chair of the Vancouver Heritage Commission, which is really what he wanted to talk about today. So it's a conversation about the market. It's a conversation about the future of the city, how we can save the soul of Vancouver while building density, something that I feel like we talk less and less about, but it's
on the show.
On the show.
On the show, but in person, I'm talking about this all the time right now.
And
this is it. I mean, we were just talking on the way. We were on a call with each other the other day when I was driving down, it was 12th. The amount of development placards, like redevelopment placards with the Broadway plan is just, it's overwhelming. And the amount also of, so now if you are shopping in kind of, I call it like the collar around, if you think of downtown as like the head and the areas that are, would be like the collar. So think about like Kits, Mount Pleasant, Fairview, like really, really fantastic neighborhoods, but all, you know, that surround Broadway. It's almost hard to buy something now, or challenging to buy something now, that is not close to something that is in review for being rezoned.
It's unbelievable. In a construction zone for the next 10 to 20 years, would you say?
Yeah.
And, but you're not alone. It's everyone in the culture around uptown.
It's everyone in like some of Vancouver's absolute best areas, right? And it's just a new thing. And I've actually talked to a few agents, and this is a very important conversation happening with every agent now, because if you get a property under contract, the first thing you're doing is learning what's going up around it. And often the towers that are coming are quite dramatic for the neighborhood, right? So lots of change happening.
Lots of change. And James, it's an interesting conversation for any number of reasons, but his take is unique. But he's putting his money where his mouth is. He's doing projects like Gibson House, which is incredible. It's right across from St. Francis of Assisi Church. Just completed. Stunning townhomes, infill townhomes. There's a single family home, duplex on the site. And it's like, I don't think many people even know how to do these types of projects anymore. But he's doing amazing work. And he's involved in multiple projects, like I said. So it's a great conversation today.
And someone who cares about building techniques and quality, which is,
I was going to say awesome. Born and bred East Van. I don't know about born and bred, but he's East Van as it comes to me.
Through and through. Very good. Well, before we get to our conversation with James, a couple things. We are sponsored, of course, by Scalina Real Estate, which is our team in Vancouver. And we've got a couple things. We've got, the trivia, the new Vancouver Real Estate / City of Vancouver trivia.
That's
remains
right.
Nameless. That should just be the title. Remains Nameless.
The Remains Nameless trivia question. I got a good one for you. It's not historical this week.
Okay.
Okay, Adam. So as everyone knows, the Invictus Games were held in Vancouver earlier this month.
Yes.
And the opening ceremony event producer, Patrick Roberge. Now, question for you. Do you know Patrick Roberge?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. I thought he might be your neighbor. But anyway, he was the event producer. He said it was the most headliner stars the sporting event had ever seen. And I'm going to ask you, I'm going to give you some of the headliners, very famous people, and I'm going to ask you to name the last one. So it's okay. A star-studded event. Okay. So who were the headliners? We had Katy Perry, Adam.
Yes.
We had Noah Kahan. You're familiar with Noah. We had Nelly Furtado, BC's own. We had Coldplay's Chris Martin. Yes. And there was one more famous person. Oh, okay. Well, before you answer.
Prince Harry.
Oh, no. It was a musician.
It has to be a musician. Okay.
It was the headliner. Yeah. So before you answer.
Yeah.
You're going to tell us about a listing that Sklina Real Estate has.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. This is actually, it would talk about a phenomenal listing. Two bed, two bath, 900 square feet at Kindred in Moodyville, 2019 building. I love Moodyville. And this is like the perfect floor plan. It's got bedrooms on opposite sides. So it's great if you have young kids, you want some separation. It's also great.
A lot of families over there.
Yeah, lots of families. It's also great if you're hosting, but really spectacular level of finish, over height ceilings, got water views, great outdoor space, and actually two different kind of patio areas. You've kind of got like your barbecue area where you can sit with a coffee and look at the view. And then you've kind of got like an evening area where you can have a fire and have a glass of wine, which is fantastic. So that is over at the site. It's listed at $929,900. And of course, comes with parking and storage, which is great. And again, you can find that at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
That's right, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And while you're there, Adam, click Sell With Us, where you can pick up the Soul Plan.
Yeah, absolutely, Matt. So the answer to the question, okay, we had Nelly Furtado.
Nelly Furtado. Chris okay. Martin.
Yes.
Noah Kahan.
Yeah.
Katy Perry. We're looking for one more name.
Wow.
You didn't watch this, I'm gathering.
No, but you know what? I went to, there was the Leafs game that night and I went with a friend of mine who was at the Invictus Games and he told me all about it. And at that Leafs game, Prince Harry came out at the beginning.
Right. Meghan Markle was there as well.
Meghan Markle was there. But I'm totally blanking. I'm going to go, it's got to be a relatively popular artist. Oh, man. This is a...
Best guess.
Geez, best guess? Maybe just because it's Vancouver, maybe the man from Burnaby himself, Michael Bublé.
Michael Bublé, a very good guess. No, it was Roxanne Bruneau.
Okay.
Quebec artist.
What? What an insane question. Like, gee, I mean, no offense to Roxanne, but really, you're
apparently
like,
she's
you think I was going to get like you're like, rock voisine was the answer. I don't know a
Roxanne
ton of...
Roxanne Bruneau.
Oh, well, I'm sure it was great. I don't want to, no disrespect, but good Lord. That was a tough one. Did anyone at home get that?
The only reason I brought it up is...
This segment's not going to last.
No. But I mean, maybe it's our age. I've never even heard of Roxanne Bruneau. Like you got Coldplay, Katy Perry, and then you got Roxanne Bruneau. Anyway.
You're becoming inside jokes to yourself. Let's hear. Let's cut to this conversation with James because I can't wait to hear this. And I had to miss this one, but I know the conversation went really well. So I know you're excited about it.
Fantastic conversation in all seriousness.
All right. Well, enjoy. This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it is also making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
Adam, we want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Soane House, one of Marcon's latest communities that features a West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced, Nordic-inspired design for architecture that endures.
Soane House offers 165 junior 1 to 3 bedroom homes in West Coquitlam, integrating nature into the built environment.
Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's marcon.ca/SOENHAUS or visit the Display Center at Outpost in Port Moody.
We also want to highlight 102 and Park. With billions already invested in Surrey City's central development over the last 15 years, the time is now to invest in its future, Surrey 3.0.
Introducing 102 and Park, a simple, straightforward skyscraper featuring 376 homes. Quite simply, this is a once-in-a-decade opportunity coming soon to Surrey's central downtown plaza. This is a time and the place to invest. Register at marcon.ca/102andpark. That's marcon.ca/102andpark.
Marcon, building for life.
Okay, so we're here with James Evans, builder and chair of the Vancouver Heritage Commission. And I should say, James, past guest, fan favorite. Welcome back on the program.
Thank you.
Maybe for our listeners who haven't heard you on the show before, and it was a couple of years ago now, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, I've been developing and building housing probably for, well, almost 30 years now, actually, throughout the Lower Mainland. My more of a recent focus has been sort of Vancouver and Burnaby focused. I've got a few projects in both Vancouver and Burnaby, but I've also done stuff in other municipalities, Surrey, Langley, you know, other places like that as well over the years. And so that's kind of it, I guess.
And you don't, I know just from your projects in Grandview Woodlands, and you have a number of them, you do heritage conversions. But you also do, you know, like Ella on Nanaimo, for instance, you were involved in. You'll do kind of multifamily projects, but then also restoration projects as well.
Yeah. So I look for opportunities like most developers do. I tend to stick or focus more on infill opportunities rather than looking at opportunities in, you know, new and emerging neighborhoods. So Ella would be a good example of that, which is that mixed-use project at Grant and Imo that got finished in 2022, if I remember right. Yeah, that's right. And, but yeah, as I say, I've also done a number of heritage conversions. I like to stick to wood frame. I don't want to get into concrete. You know, typical project size would be, you know, anywhere from 7 to 75 units, somewhere in that range. But, you know, it's provided that they fall into the category of you know, either single-family, townhouse, or mixed use or condos or rentals as well. Those are the kind of projects that I focus on.
Opportunistic, I guess. But as you go along in the business, do you find you're kind of narrowing your focus in terms of geographically? Like, are you doing more and more in East Van, or is it the opposite, that you're kind of expanding your scope as you develop your developer career?
Well, so I guess when I started off on my own as opposed to working for somebody else, which is about 15 years ago now, I had to figure out what I wanted to focus on and where I wanted to focus on stuff. So firstly, I focused on the form of development that I was talking about earlier, which is, you know, ground-oriented wood frame, essentially. And then I started with the neighborhoods that I was most familiar with and the cities I was most familiar with, which was, you know, Surrey, Langley, you know, Vancouver to a lesser extent, Burnaby, you know, and I also had to figure out exactly where I wanted to be. I didn't really want to be in a new neighborhood competing with some of the bigger developers out there, because that's just, you know, that's a good way to kind of annihilate yourself if things get tough. And it just sort of evolved from there. So I didn't really have, I had more of a focus on the form of development in the areas I wanted to, you know, to develop stuff rather than municipalities. And, you know, there's obviously, if you're going to take and do infill stuff, there's a lot more opportunities in the, you know, in the existing urban neighborhoods, like, you know, like Vancouver, Burnaby, or cities that are fully developed, as opposed to places like, you know, Surrey, where there's a lot of new development, greenfield development that's taking place in new neighborhoods and so on and so forth. You know, having said that, I have over the past couple of years done a couple of single family projects down in South Surrey, but they were not in, you know, in the new emerging neighborhoods in Grandview. They were in established neighborhoods like Ocean Park, for example. We did a project of 49 single family homes in Ocean Park a few years ago.
Fantastic. And so right now you're the chair of the Vancouver Heritage Commission, James. Right. I guess two things. Can you tell us about the Vancouver Heritage Commission? What is it? What's the purpose and the mandate? And also how and why you got involved.
So the Heritage Commission was set up. I don't actually know when it was set up, but it's been part of one of the many advisory bodies that the city of Vancouver has that's been there for many, many years. It consists of, I think people are on a commission, I think there's 10 of us, if I remember right. We all get appointed to 2-year terms. It's a mix of, people who have, interest in heritage, and they come from a diverse series of backgrounds. There's some architects, there's a couple of builders and developers, there's other professionals who are in there who are part of it as well. They're really sort of a very diverse range of individuals who are there. It's generally meets monthly, and its mandate is to provide advice to council on projects that are received by the city to, that have a heritage component. So, examples might include, most of the ones we've seen recently in the Broadway corridor, for example. There's been a couple of projects in the industrial area where they're proposing to take and redevelop a site, but there's an old building that's on the site right now. They tend to be larger sites where the existing building is a fairly small footprint. So they look to take and redevelop the heritage building, repurpose it for whatever use they're proposing, and then build a bunch of new stuff around that. So that's the sort of stuff that we've been seeing recently. In Vancouver, there's actually a fairly large suite of heritage preservation tools that are available as well, which are evaluated by staff. But there's heritage revitalization agreements, which, in a nutshell, encourage heritage preservation by providing some relaxations to things like density setbacks, so on and so forth, in order to preserve a heritage asset. They also had density transfer program as well. So if you had a site that had a certain amount of density on it, let's say you had a site that you had an existing 4 or 5 story building on it, it's designated for an 8-story building or something like that, and there's some extra density available on the site, then you have the ability to bank that density and then turn around and transfer it to other areas of Vancouver as well. So those are the main policy tools they've got. There are some grants that they can also provide, mainly facade grants, which are up to $50,000, if I remember right, to encourage property owners to restore things like cornices or bricks or things like that on their buildings. So those are the main sort of tools. And this will be my 4th year. And after, year 2 that I was there, I got approached by the chair who was stepping down and asked if I would take over the position, because, of course, I got some experience having done some heritage projects and, of course, an interest and passion in heritage. And so I ended up being elected chair. I didn't realize that also came with the responsibility of being a director on the Vancouver Heritage Foundation. So that's another role that I occupy. And then I'm also the heritage liaison to the Development Permit Board. Whenever there's projects that come forward to the Development Permit Board that have a heritage component on it, then they seek advice from the Heritage Commission as well. So that's also another one.
Just out of curiosity, is that when they're seeking advice, are those down to like single family projects that you're advising on?
No, they are more along the lines of, let's look at this example and I don't see quite as many of these anymore, but somebody's got an old house, you'd be familiar with them. There's been a number of them done in our neighborhood in Grampian Woodlands. They want to take and save and restore the house and get some extra density in exchange for that, or some relaxations to build a coach house or so on and so forth. Those are generally dealt with administratively. We tend to see the ones that are kind of a larger scale where, there might be a house on a larger site, maybe, like I'd say 66 foot lot or something like that. And it's got, a heritage component, but a bunch of new development around it. So they seek advice from the Heritage Commission on, the level of preservation, does the form of development work? How does it fit? So on and so forth, a bunch of stuff like that. The City of Vancouver used to use the Heritage Revitalization Agreement tool quite a bit. And unfortunately, I haven't seen any of those now in a couple of years. They seem to have moved away from those, and I've never really been sure why. Those were a very effective policy tool. In fact, you're probably familiar with the Jeffs project that I did years ago. That's the policy tool that we used to do that particular project. And as I say, they used to do that fairly routinely. It's a bit more complex because it's kind of like a rezoning, and that you have to go to council for approval, but you don't actually change the zone. Basically, you get council approval to add density and allow for additional setbacks or whatever sort of relaxations are necessary in order to take and make it work, the project work. and it's a bit more involved on the staff level because you have to go through an internal performer review. You have to, of course, go to the Heritage Commission. There's a couple more steps, but it's just dealt with through the DP process, the development permit process, rather than going through the full rezoning process.
You know, James, maybe taking a step back, I feel like we used to hear, and I think I can speak for in general terms, at least it seems to me, that we used to hear a lot more about heritage than we do today. You know, say even 5, 7, 8 years ago, it seems like it was a larger part of the conversation. And I guess before we get into whether or not you agree with that or why that's actually the case, just for our listeners that maybe have no background in heritage, like, why is heritage preservation important?
Well, so as to your first point, you're right. There does seem to be less interest in that. I recall, about 10, maybe even 15 years ago, when we saw, the large scale, loss of character properties, mainly over on the west side, character and heritage properties. I kind of use the term interchangeably. And there was a lot of sensitivity to it at that point in time. There's a lot of media was generated by it. And it actually did prompt the city to go and change a lot of their zones to actually provide baked incentive in the various zones to encourage heritage preservation. The typical tool that they would give you is to give you basically an extra 10% density in exchange for the retention of the home. There doesn't seem to be nearly as much interest in it in the community right now. I mean, if you get like, and as I referring to earlier, recently Dunsmuir House, which was a large old hotel that had been vacant for, I think, about 10 or 15 years or something like that, was demolished, and that attracted a lot of attention. And that happened, I think, just a few weeks ago. But otherwise, there seems to be sort of less and less interest in it. I'm not really sure why that's the case, whether or not. Because one of the challenges is that there's a lot of competing interests right now for land, right? We've got housing. We all know that we have a housing challenge, both in terms of affordability and just lack of housing. We all know about all the, these infrastructure challenges. Of course, there's this avalanche of legislation that's come down from the province over the past couple of years to mandate additional density and in single family neighborhoods around transit oriented areas and all the rest of that sort of stuff like that. And it sort of feels like heritage just really can't compete with all those other competing objectives right now. It's just not very high on the radar, which is lamentable in my view. To your second question, why do I think it's important to keep them, and why have I done a number of these projects myself? Because they're not easy. I think it's important to keep touch points of the past. Vancouver is a very young city. We really don't have all that much in the way of heritage stock or stories for that matter, as opposed to, if you go to Europe, where there's a large stock of older buildings. Here we don't have much of that. And I think, we need to preserve some of that. So I'm not suggesting for a moment that we need to keep every old thing that's in there, but there are some legacy properties that either have stories associated with the building, or they happen to be a landmark building, or, you look at the Marine Building downtown, for example. There's the Hudson's Bay Building. I mean, those are legacy buildings that have story behind them, and they're really, really good examples of heritage buildings that were built in the particular era in which they were built. You can make an argument, or less of an argument, I guess, for, maybe a house was built in 1915 by somebody, maybe doesn't have much of a story and it's got less importance in there. But I think it's important to have a mix of old and new, as opposed to just, racing to knock everything down and build new. The other thing too is, we all talk about, environmental sustainability. I mean, the most sustainable building that you can build is the one that you keep and refurbish rather than the one that you bulldoze and send off to landfill. And of course, that becomes an increasingly important, consideration as we're taking to developing properties. We contend with, climate change and so on and so forth. And in fact, I actually think I did one of the last project that we did. We actually went through a bit of an analysis to determine what the embedded carbon would be associated with keeping an old building relative to knocking it down. And, it's going to move the needle? No, but we all need to take and do what we can do in order to take and respond to this imminent threat that we've got as climate changes.
And so you kind of touched on it, but one thing I just wanted to expand on a little bit. So in your mind, in terms of heritage retention, you mentioned some buildings, Hudson's Bay Building, kind of important landmarks in the city. But then there's, areas of Kits entirely that are, zoned to retain that kind of community character. Are they kind of two sides of the same coin in your mind, or are we talking about kind of two fundamentally different things?
Well, you know, heritage, and this is actually a conversation we've been having recently with the city and around the mission table as well. You know, I mean, we generally think of heritage being associated with buildings, but they can be associated with places as well, or histories of a particular place. And there's also been, increasing awareness, and we're actually trying to figure out how to bring this into the conversations with the with the Heritage Commission about the importance of some of these sites to the Indigenous community as well. You know, we tend to, at least traditionally, have taken a very sort of Eurocentric view and approach to heritage. You know, there's a piece of property, it gets, a lot gets subdivided, I don't know, 1907 or something like that. It gets built by Mr. and Mrs. Smith, who then live in it for a certain period of time, and then it gets fixed up. But, you know, that land's been around for a long time. What happened before the site was subdivided? Did it have some sort of cultural significance? I think that we need to spend some more time looking at that and telling a more holistic story, you know, about the sites. You know, to come to your question about kids or other neighborhoods, it's not just a building, it's about the sense of place. And, you know, maybe there are some particular streets that have some particular cultural significance. I mean, the one that I think of, which is a really good intact, you know, block of character homes, is on the East 10th Avenue bike route. You know, if you cycle down along East 10th Avenue and on the south side, there's this lovely collection of old heritage buildings that are, you know, on this nice leafy street. You know, or Mole Hill. There's another really good example of a block that's been retained with essentially all the original houses on there. And, you know, so that's kind of a touchstone of what the West End used to look like, as opposed to what happened to it in the 1960s, when a lot of that was redeveloped with apartment buildings, and then more increasingly with larger buildings as a result of the West End plan. So, you know, you get to sort of see the evolution by looking at things like this. You know, one of the things that's happened to these neighborhoods like Kitsilano or Grandview or Mount Pleasant, which is where a lot of the heritage stock is that the city, in response to the provincial legislation, came basically dispensed with the character retention provision of the zoning bylaw to come up with this new multiplex zone, which they're mandated to do by the province. But to use, and then they basically took all of the different RS zones, there's about nine of them in the city, and they consolidated them all into this new multiplex zone. So under the previous RS zones, you got an extra 10% density, a bonus density in return for attaining a building. They basically left that in place, but allowed you to get up to a 1 FSR to, for being able to brand new multiplex on. So what they've done is they've actually now flipped it on its head. So it's actually a disincentive to keep an old building as opposed to retaining them, which I think is a mistake. You know, so there's really no incentive now in a lot of these neighborhoods in Kitsilano or in Grandview or Mount Pleasant or anywhere else. There, Carriesdale, Dunbar, you know, those neighborhoods where there's a large stock of old character buildings. There's no incentive to keep them anymore. And so they're all just getting knocked out, which is unfortunate, at least by the
way. Yeah, I'm just thinking of, we've had people on the show over the years. So I'm trying to channel some of our past guests here. And is there, for people that are dead set on density by any means necessary, that approach, you know, we're in a housing crisis, we need density. Is there, in your mind, like I think the question would be, is there the ability to densify with retaining the old buildings, or densify in a way that we need to, and then the challenges involved in that, the complications, potentially slow things down or make it not as interesting. Can retention and density work together in a better way than we have it right now?
Yes. I sort of give that a qualified yes. So I think it's best to look at, you know, maybe take some typical examples. Like in Kitsilano, for example, there's a lot of the old California bungalow homes, which are, you know, these single level homes with a deck that goes along the full length of the front of the house. And, you know, they all look like these little sort of gingerbread homes. They typically run around 1,600 square feet. They're 1.5 stories. You know, they're really underbuilt relative to what you could build on them in the lots today. And it's difficult to come up with a way to preserve those and meet, and to achieve the full density on those lots, because you would have to, you know, surgically alter those homes in such a way that they'd almost be unrecognizable. But when you've got situations where you've got homes that are, you know, maybe a Edwardian or Craftsman style home that was built in the, you know, in around the turn of the century, 1910, 1912, somewhere in that range, those homes can range anywhere from 2,400 to 2,800 square feet on your typical 33-foot lot, which under the old zone was actually pretty close to what your density was that you'd be, allowed to do.
Right.
You know, of course, under the new multiplex zone, you can get potentially up to 4 units on that lot, you get a 1 FSR. So it is possible to save those buildings in those kind of circumstances, but you need to load more of your density in the back. And sometimes there's practical constraints, you know, hydro utilities, maybe other constraints that really make that very difficult to achieve. And you also need to have some additional density above and beyond just the base density you get to justify that, because saving these old buildings is expensive. You know, not only do you have to try and preserve the building and include a lot of the original material that's in there to the extent that you can, so you're putting in wood windows instead of vinyl, and you know, so on and so forth, shingles instead of hardy. It's you have to take and obviously rain screen them and upgrade them seismically and then put them all back together again to make them look like they were when they were built, you know, 100 years ago. You know, so you really need to effectively get an extra somewhere probably between 10% and 20% density in order to make you indifferent between starting new and keeping the old building on there. And then can you actually physically fit all that on the lot and make it work? So it's really hard with the smaller lots. Where it does work well is for the larger lots. So, you know, in Kerrisdale and Dunbar, you use those neighborhoods as examples, with a lot of 50, 66 foot lots. And on those ones, you actually have enough. You know, I call it kind of heritage preservation my bad habit. I use the new build around it because that's predictable. Try and offset the additional costs associated with heritage. So if I'm doing a project like Jeff's or Brookhouse, which are two of them that you'd be familiar with on the east side, you know, there's a bunch of new build around that as well. And that was predictable. I could make that work. And then, you really never quite know what you're getting into when you get into the heritage stuff. And, you know, by the time you're done your original budget and when you actually finally spend on these things, you're two different things and usually not in the right direction. But where it does work is like, let's take a 50 foot lot over on the west side. And this is something that seems to be just kind of emerging with the city right now. With a 50 foot lot, you can do 6 units under a multiplex. And if you've got an old house, you can save that and make it part of the development. Most people don't bother because there's no reason to do it. However, the city seems to be looking to amalgamate an existing council policy that was approved years ago, where council basically provided a 10% blanket bonus density across the city for heritage retention, which is now baked into things like the Broadway plan and the like, to layer that on top of your base density so you'd actually get a 1.1 instead of 1 FSR. And then the other thing, too, is that with the multiplex zone, you're capped at 4 units or 6 units. That's it, depending on your lot size. There's no cap if you're doing a heritage preservation. So, in fact, if you could make it work, you could, in theory, do 7 or 8 units if you can make them work on a 50-foot lot if you kept the old building. So between that and the additional density that you'd be able to achieve, that might actually tip the scales in favor of considering some of these buildings. I mean, this isn't a policy that's been enshrined by the city yet. They're actually reviewing it right now, and they're probably going to come up with something later this year to look at how to bring some incentives back to the new multiplex zone on it, but it's something that staff are prepared to support. And I think they're actually looking to try and do a couple of pilot projects to see how this all works, because nobody kind of knows really what the form of development looks like. You know, I tried to, this project I did at Park in Victoria that I alluded to earlier called Brookhouse, which you're probably familiar with. And we put 10 units on a 66 foot lot there at a 1.35 FSR. So we got 6 units in the heritage house. We added a small wing onto it. And then 4 townhomes in the back. We figured out all the challenges that, of course, have emerged with the whole multiplex conversation in terms of where you put the hydro transformer and, you know, how do you deal with all the sort of stuff that you need to take and put on sites nowadays. And that project worked well on there. And I actually cited that to staff. I said, well, you know, why are you trying to reinvent the conversation about multiplexes? Why don't you look at some projects that have been done, whether they're mine or by others? There's lots of other buildings over the years who've done them. Let's look at those and study those and figure out what lessons were learned and how we can improve upon that. But there wasn't much interest in doing that. They just wanted to do the big, bright, shiny object at that point in time was to do this new multiplex thing. And to be fair to the city, they were under pressure because they had specific timelines they needed to meet under the provincial legislation.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible. This podcast is sponsored by Fenway by Caliber, bringing 209 new homes and 24,000 square feet of retail space to Willoughby Town Center.
And this retail component isn't just adding to the area, Adam. It's enhancing an already thriving community hub where neighbors connect over boutique shopping, great food, and everyday essentials. This is one of the final new construction opportunities to own in the heart of Langley's Willoughby Town Center.
And speaking of Langley, is it me or is Langley all you hear about these days? It's become such a powerhouse with over 7,000 businesses, the population set to double by 2040, and that SkyTrain extension arriving in 2029.
What's incredible about this location is that you're getting the best of everything. Your steps from the Langley Events Center, currently undergoing a massive $149 million expansion. The new Tennis Center and future Willoughby Community Center are right across the street. Plus, you've got the new Smith Athletic Park just down the road.
The location really is unbeatable, with 8 schools within walking distance and just minutes from Highway 1. And what I love is that this is a caliber project. They're Langley locals with decades of experience who really understand this community. They've partnered with Polyco Group to bring decades of development expertise to Fenway.
With Langley's population set to double and transit connectivity expanding, this is your chance to be part of BC's fastest growing community. Register at fenwayliving.com. That's FENWAY living.com.
Fenway, where small town heart meets urban sophistication.
We are also sponsored by Oakwin Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakwin, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakwin.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
Well, and I should say, I walk by that project every morning with my dogs, and it's a stunning. Everybody should drive by Park and Victoria and take a look. That's a stunning project, which kind of leads to my next question. You know, going back to all the process of constructing one of these, I guess, retrofits and making them look the way you have in the past. Are there enough people with the skills and the knowledge to actually? Like, is that one of the challenges here, that there's just not enough people that have the ability to take a project like this on?
No, there's lots of other people that are, you know, out there in the building community who are interested in doing that sort of thing as well. It's just that it's hard. You know, we all know in our business that time is money, and you want to get to the finish line as quickly as possible, and you want to get there the easiest way possible. You know, bulldozing something and starting brand new is nothing's easy in this business. It's easier than trying to figure out how to go through the extra hoops, the regulatory hoops to take and save one of these things. Of course, you're always running into code issues and challenges. And, you know, there's got to be a reason to be able to do that. The other thing, too, is that, you know, if you're trying to save an old building, you have to work within the fabric of a building that was never designed to be converted into a into multiple unit building. Most of these single family homes were built as single family homes. So if you're suddenly going to try and put 2 or 3 or 4 units in them, but you still have to work with the existing window placement and the existing, geometry of the building and all the rest of that sort of stuff, then, you know, how do you actually fit livable units that the market expects and that you can sell today into that building? I mean, that's a big challenge in and of itself. Because some buildings are ill-suited being converted. Like, I go back to the California bungalow example that I was using earlier. You know, it's really hard to turn those into, you could probably turn those into a single family house with a basement suite, but that's really about the best that you could do with it. Whereas that project on Parkland Victoria that I was talking about, that was a large Queen Anne style house. I think it was about 5,000 square feet or so, with a door that was at the center of the house as opposed to off to the side. So it lent itself well to being able to kind of walk in the front door, and then you could have units on either side of the building.
Right.
So there's just a whole bunch of things like that I've learned over the years as well. That unit had a turret. You ever tried to furnish a turret? You know, room with 8 sides. That's a challenge. Yeah. You know, all these things you have to sort of think about. And then once you've done it, I mean, I happen to like it because I have a passion for that sort of thing. And I find it a bit of a challenge as opposed to just building the sort of, you know, the new build stuff, right? We all know what a mixed use building looks like in a townhouse building or a townhouse is. And, you know, they're all kind of the same. Whereas if you have one of these heritage buildings in the project, it actually does a couple of things. Firstly, it gives you a story to tell because you can wrap the rest of the whole project around it. And secondly, it just adds a little bit of diversity and interest, you know, to it. And that was actually one of my big takeaways from my first heritage project in Vancouver. We did 20 units on it. There were 7 units in the heritage house and then 13 townhomes. So all the townhomes were, you know, three bedroom, three level, dropped roughly 1,300 square foot townhomes. We all know what those look like. There's an established market for it. And then we had seven units in this heritage house. They were all kind of weird because we, you know, they had kitchens in weird spots, windows in weird spots, strange, you know, strange ceiling heights, all the rest of that sort of stuff. And I was terrified we were going to end up with this white elephant. Nobody wanted to buy this stuff. And so when we brought the project to the market, we didn't release the heritage house initially because it was behind the rest of the new build. But we had a lot of interest in it. So we brought it to the market the following weekend and sold the whole thing on the weekend. I had a backup offer on one of the units. I went, holy. So, and I realized that the things that I was absolutely, you know, terrified by, the market actually valued. Because, well, let's face it, a two-bedroom condo is a two-bedroom condo is a two-bedroom condo. The only thing that really differentiates them is what floor are you on, which way are you facing, and what neighborhood are you in. You know, but that one-bedroom unit that we built at the top of Jess, for example, that had the turret in it, there will only ever be one of those.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's sort of a unique, and that's, you know, the other thing too is, you know, as we move towards building more and more towers and more, you know, mixed-use projects in this neighborhood, you're kind of losing some of the identity that is, I'll call it special sauce that, you know, that makes Vancouver what it is. And people value that. So if you can find a way to kind of keep some of the special sauce here and there as you're redeveloping neighborhoods and adding housing, because we all know we need more housing, I think that's a real win-win for everybody.
You know, I'm just thinking of, you know, all you say about that, the market response is interesting. And it's kind of like, it's sort of predictable once you tell the story, but yeah, I can see why you'd be nervous about it at the time. If you could wave a magic wand right now, like, because honestly, like I'm listening going, man, this sounds, you know, say the project on Parker and Victoria, that sounds super, almost like a puzzle, super interesting, super unique, really kind of, you know, an engaging project to be involved in, but it also kind of scares the hell out of me. And I'm sure it probably scares the hell out of a lot of people. Is there, if you could wave a magic wand and change policy where it would incentivize people to kind of take on that, I don't want to say risk, but that kind of scary kind of component of these projects, like what can the city do in your mind to inspire people to move in this direction?
Well, I think that answer is threefold. One of them, make the regulatory process competitive with the current regulatory process for getting doing a multiplex or a new single family home. So simplify, get rid of some of the extra layers that you need to go through with it. The add, you know, provide an incentive to do it again so that a prospective builder or developer would be indifferent between keeping an old building and building a new one. And then also, you know, the other thing I didn't really get into are the code challenges that you run into with a lot of these things. So, you know, it's almost as if they're working at cross purposes. By the time you need to structure and upgrade these things, you need to meet today's sustainability requirements, STEP code requirements, or the Vancouver Building Bylaw requirements, in the case of Vancouver, on them. You know, how do you add exterior insulation to one of these old homes and then keep the same essence of what it was, because then it screws up, you know, your window proportions and your doors and all the rest of that sort of stuff like that. Because you need certain, if you're trying to restore it to what it was originally, of course you need to have the same sort of proportions that you had with respect to your doors and your openings and all the rest of that sort of stuff. So, and there are actually some relaxations, but they're really hard to find in the code here. So I think it's part 13 in the Vancouver Building Bylaw actually provides some specific exemptions for them. So those are the big, you know, things, add an incentive, simplify the approvals and the regulatory process, and simplify the code with respect to the retention of these old buildings. And, you know, having done, maybe I should qualify it a little bit. There's projects that I've done that I call here, you know, heritage restorations, where I have a pristine building. The objective is to try and preserve it in situ more or less as it is. Wilmar, which was a project I did over on the west side many years ago, is an example of that. Some of the other ones, I'll use the one again at Parker and Victoria, that's more of what I call heritage rescue. You know, the building had been covered with asbestos siding over the years. All the windows have been replaced. The inside had been, the house had been converted into four units. So a lot of the heritage elements inside, like the wainscoting and all the rest of that, have been ripped out. So, you know, the only thing that really identified as being an old building was the form of the building. So that was, and it was essentially falling down. So that was a heritage rescue. You know, we basically Took the building, we gutted the inside, we redeveloped it, turned it into 6 units on there, and then essentially restored the exterior of the building to make it look like it did 100 years ago when it was built. So I know that like part of that building actually is hardy on it because we had a code issue we needed to deal with, but I would challenge the casual observer to take and actually differentiate where we made the transition between wood siding and hardy. You know, and all the other things like that. So, you know, to your typical passerby who would go by that thing, they would go look at that. Oh, it's a lovely old house that's been restored. It looks like it did 100 years ago. Great. But you have to make compromises on this thing. So, you know, if it's hard to be a heritage purist when you're trying to restore these old buildings in Vancouver because, you know, you need to take and accede to the requirements that we have today, you know, for life safety issues. As I say, obviously, the way they built these things structurally years ago with things like balloon framing and things like that don't pass muster today.
You know, I'm trying to think of how to frame this question because I feel like Grandview Woodlands is like a perfect neighborhood to kind of think about the right way to densify, or at least a good place to argue over the right way to densify, in that it has, you know, it's an established community. You talk about the special sauce. I think everybody can agree that there's something uniquely special about that neighborhood and it should be protected. There seems like there's the ongoing debate argument. I'm not even sure where we're at with the Safeway at Broadway and Commercial and you know, the threat to the neighborhood. I guess I'm just thinking of all of this in relation to, you know, and this was kind of more an argument you'd hear 4 or 5 years ago about kind of, you know, especially on the West Side, like this NIMBY element would reach for anything to kind of gum up the process of new construction. And I think, you know, neighborhood, what would you even call it? I can't even think of the word right now, but, you know, the authentic neighborhood, say, as an argument is one that you'd hear. And I guess this is all leading to, like, how do you foresee, say, Grandview Woodland densifying in a way that would be, you know, that would keep that special sauce in the neighborhood while actually providing more housing and welcoming, you know, people that can't afford to live in Vancouver right now into the neighborhood?
Well, that's a much bigger, broader policy question that I, you know,
yeah,
than I'm equipped to answer. And of course, everybody will have their own opinions about that. You know, Grandview Woodlands is fortunate that not only has it got an interesting building form, it's also got some interesting streetscapes too, because of the fact that it was, you know, developed gradually over the years. So it was an area around Commercial Drive and East, what is it, 4th? I think it's 4th Avenue, 5th and 6th, where the lot topography doesn't match anything else. So there's this little sort of enclave between McSpadden Park and Commercial Drive, where you've got all these 25-foot lots and the roads don't line up with the lots across the street.
Right.
And you've got the same thing actually up by Victoria and what's across the street between William and Napier. And those had to do with the fact that those particular properties, in the case of the ones up on Victoria Drive, there's an 18-acre parcel there that was developed by a gentleman by the name of Captain Cobb back in the late 1800s. And he actually built his mansion there. In fact, it's still standing, called the Cobb Residence. But, you know, at the time, the lotting pattern was typically 50-foot wide roads, 25-foot lots. And then and he, you know, developed that, subdivided the site. But because there weren't any services to it at the time, it was really kind of way off in the hinterlands. Nothing happened. There were a couple of homes that got built there. There's a couple of Queen Anne-style homes that date from the late 1800s that were built on that site. Then nothing happened. And then gradually, when the sewer and services got extended to Commercial Drive in the early 1900s, then it kind of opened up the neighborhood. And then other lots around there got developed. But that was sort of their typical 33-foot lot and 66-foot wide road pattern. So you end up with these, you know, it just sort of makes it interesting to walk around and go, why do these not line up? And why does, you know, it's kind of weird. Then you add on the additional layer of the different types of housing that are on there. Because not everything was developed at the same time. You get everything from Vancouver specials to post-war bungalows that were built after the war to, of course, some buildings that were built at the turn of the century. Now, that all makes it really, really interesting. So, you know, how do you separate what's the must-keep from what's the must-be-redeveloped? And that's sort of happening gradually as you know, some of these older places are, you know, or these post-war bungalows that are really underbuilt relative to what you build in lots today are knocked down and redeveloped. And so you go from one house to 3 units potentially on those lots. So, the density is being added very, very gradually on there. You know, the challenge with that, of course, is that you end up with one particular form of development that's in there that's only really affordable to a particular segment of the market. So your typical form that you end up with a duplex and an infill in the back is probably, you know, a front-back duplex, three bedrooms for each of those. And then if you've got an infill at the back, it might be a two-bedroom carriage house or something similar to that. You know, that's, there's only a certain segment of the market that can afford that. And that form of development is also sort of ill-suited to certain people. Not everybody needs to live in a three-bedroom, you know, half duplex. That's probably better suited to a, you know, young family with a couple of kids. Yeah. But you're, if you're downsizer, you don't really want to live in that. You probably want a condo, one or two bedrooms or something like that. And, you know, that's, it's hard to go and change, you know, it's hard to make that work. Certainly under the existing established guidelines, really what we should look to do is try and salt and pepper some low density apartment buildings in some of these neighborhoods, just, you know, on a, done in a sensitive way, you know, to provide a greater mix of housing types. And I mean, I'm not going to use the term affordable because there's no such thing in this town, but, you know, it's all relative. And, you know, so I think we really do need to try and find ways to enhance and grow the stock of housing, but not do so in the sort of, you know, kind of with the Vancouver approach, where the, you know, approach seems to be, let's just drop high rises everywhere. It's kind of like dropping a grenade into a neighborhood somewhere. You know, think about what's going to happen. Back to my comment on the 10th Avenue bike route, there's a bunch of high rises proposed in that stretch between Main and Fraser on this sort of leafy street with single family homes right now. It's going to fundamentally alter what that is. I think there's a way that you could have done that more sensitively on there, but it is what it is. So I think there's, there's certainly some more discussions that could be had with the city and with communities as well to come up with ways to better add density to neighborhoods, whether it's Kitsilano or Mount Pleasant or Granby Woodlands or, you know, pick your neighborhood, but do so in a way that preserves the essence of what the neighborhood is as well. And, you know, and to be fair, there are certain targets the city needs to meet now in terms of the meeting the requirements that have been imposed upon them by the provincial legislation for multiplexes and transit-oriented development. And, you know, I think that could have been done in a more sensitive way to, instead of mandate, I mean, the province mandate density targets and form of development around some of these areas, just to simply give them population targets. Okay, around the SkyTrain, you need to have a, come up with a plan that provides for a certain population target within the, you know, the life of a plan, which is probably typically 20 or 30 years. Mm. But, and then leave it to the cities to figure out how you come up with the density and the form of development around there to hit that target. Because not, you know, the, not all neighborhoods are the same. There's areas around transit stations, you know, the area around Commercial and Broadway is very different than what you got around the Nanaimo station, which you've got, say, in Joyce Collingwood or Brentwood, for example. You know, the cities have been kind of grappling with that. And unfortunately, they've, you know, they've basically been given their marching orders and they've got to comply with it. But it's going to have dramatic effects on the neighborhoods around the SkyTrain station, certainly.
You know, maybe as a final question, and we've talked a lot about how heritage can work in adding housing, and you have this new project and it's a couple blocks away from my house. I walked by as it was being built. It was, I'd love to hear the story because I feel like I have it right. You know, St. Francis of the Assisi Church,
right,
is involved. Gibson's residences, I should say. And it's just completing now. So can you tell us how this kind of fits in with the kind of the heritage preservation and how it matches with the community? And yeah, just love to hear about the project.
Sure. So, well, a little bit about the history of the site. It was a the original building was built in 1907, I think, or 08, by a fellow by the name of Mr. Gibson. And it was actually, he built a large house on a 99-foot lot. So it was three lots that he bought and built this large house on it. He actually had his original orchard in the back and a little farm. And he lived there for actually only a couple of years and then sold it to a fellow who's actually a local real estate developer in the neighborhood, a guy by the name of Baines, who lived in there until he passed away in the 1940s. And at that point in time, he was approached by the Franciscans, who, of course, St. Francis of Assisi Church, and they wanted to buy the property to actually to take and turn into a school. So that was their original intent behind it. And they the property got sold to the church in 1948. And then after they bought the thing, they realized it wasn't really well suited for a school. So they ended up building a school at the corner of Victoria and Venables. And then it's, what they decided to do was instead convert the property into a convent. So it was for the Order of Poor Clares, actually, who were there, and the nuns who lived there were the teachers at school. So there was a group of about six or seven of them that lived there for years and years until it was late 1990s, early 2000s when they passed away. And then at that point in time, the church held on to it, but they leased it out to another church group, Orthodox group, actually, and they used it as a church. And so they kept the original house that was there, and then they added this large wing when the nuns were there, because that became an area. There was a little open space downstairs that could be used as a gym or a gathering area. On the main floor was their kitchen and then a place of worship in the addition that they added, and then the upper level were bedrooms. And anyway, fast forward to a couple of years ago, and the St. Francis of Assisi was going through a process to redevelop their school because they needed to upgrade it, and a whole series of things like that. And so they were looking at their assets, and this site they didn't have a need for anymore. So I ended up talking to them, and we ended up doing a deal to develop the property. So it sits on 333 foot lots. And the zoning in the area at the time is RT5, which contemplated, that allows for duplexes, or at least at the time. And so I went into the city and said, well, why don't we look at, so what are the development options? Of course, their standard fare was, well, keep the house, build an infill in behind it, and build some duplexes. I sort of looked at that and I thought that you could do better than that. I sort of thought, well, why don't we, instead of building a duplex form, bust these buildings up into two to create this little sort of collection of home cottages on them, and then keep the house and split that into a front back duplex, because it's actually got an entrance from the from the front. And then it actually originally had a side entrance as well, which was removed many years ago, and we've restored it to use that as an entrance for the back of the building. I had, shall we say, some lively conversations with planning staff because I didn't really support them. But fortunately, I got the attention of the director of planning, who was supportive of it. And the result was approvals for a 7-unit project. So 5 infill homes. They're all, 3-bedroom, single-family homes that are, around 1,400 square feet, give or take a little bit. And then the original building. So we knocked off the wing and restored the original building and picked it up and actually moved it as well. So it was kind of centered in the center of the site, sort of moved it over the corner. And that was the process. So that's a good example of a way that you could add some density in there. I think, in retrospect, probably could have been a little bit more aggressive, but that's what the planning thinking was at the time. And as you say, it's near completion. It's been great.
And then, so the number of cottages, it's such an awesome, even the way you describe it, it makes me think it's such a great fit for the neighborhood. But the number of actual homes in Gibson's residences?
So it's one more than you would get under the existing base zone, because the existing base zone allowed 6. That was an example where we were able to use the character incentive retention provision. So we got an extra 10% density bonus, which enabled that extra unit. And that was the incentive to retain and restore the old house. But that was part of it. And the other was form of development as well, because the typical form of development that you see throughout Grandview Woodlands right now under the existing zoning is duplexes, front back duplexes. And, they're showing up everywhere. But people generally, all things being equal, if you have an option to buy a duplex or a single family home, people like to have their own 4 walls. It's at the cost, obviously, you've got a little bit less outdoor space and there's a few other things that you have to compromise, but you got your own 4 walls. So it's back to your, term affordable. I'm going to call it an affordable option to buy a single family home in Vancouver, not that there is any such thing. Your median price for a single family home, so I think in our neighborhood now is, $2.5 million, something like that, and probably more actually. And that's not affordable to a lot of people.
And do these all have their own address, or is it unit 1, 2? Okay.
No, they all live and smell and feel and function as single family homes, except the Heritage House, which is a duplex.
Right. And it's at Napier and...
It's one block east of Victoria Drive.
Yeah,
it's right opposite.
That's right, yeah.
It's right opposite St. Francis of Assisi Church.
Perfect. Well, we do have a segment to close out the show here, James, called the five supposedly lighthearted questions that we've recently changed and are not as lighthearted anymore. Do you have time to stick around for that?
Sure.
This podcast is brought to you by Spark, the new development sales and marketing platform.
Adam, the stakes have never been higher for launching a condo project, and today's developers and brokerage teams need to leverage the best tools in order to hit their financing thresholds and to sell out their projects.
Spark is an all-in-one sales and marketing software that includes a comprehensive CRM, inventory management, email marketing, and digital contracts. These tools are custom tailored to the pre-sale process to help you capture leads, increase inventory yield, and transact contracts seamlessly.
And here's the best part, Adam. Spark's team is headquartered right here in Yale Town, and they have over 10 years of experience in helping BC-based developers and brokers bring their projects to market.
So if you're selling a new development, you need to check out Spark at spark.re/VREP. That's spark.re/VREP. And remember, Matt, you can't light the pre-sale world on fire without a spark.
What is one of the best and most worthwhile investments you've ever made?
Well, best financially was a junior mining company that was owned by a friend of mine. And most of the time you end up not making any money on these, but they ended up actually finding something in the ground. We kind of joke. Our businesses are both the same, right? We both go out, we find a piece of land somewhere and we both dig a hole in it. In my case, I put a building in the hole. In his case, hopes to find something. You know, sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. And anyway, we managed to make enough on that one that it let us buy a camper van that we used to drive up to the Yukon.
Oh, nice. I was going to say, you're the first person I've ever heard that has made any money doing that. I feel like I've tried and consistently failed a number of times.
No, and I've failed lots of times too, but that one worked.
Oh, man, that's exciting. What is an unusual habit or absurd thing you love?
Traveling.
I'll take it.
It's not an absurd habit, but it's something that I love. I just don't have time for it.
Is there, in terms of where you've been, the place you'd like to return?
I'd like to go back to Burma, which I guess is now Myanmar. I'd love to go back to Russia. I took a train across Russia a few years ago, which was lovely. Of course, that's probably not a good idea right now.
Right.
The only continent I have yet to visit is Africa. So that's definitely on the bucket list as well.
Right on. In the last 5 years, what have you become better at saying no to?
I don't know if you're going to like the answer to this. Yeah. Broker's trying to sell me real estate that doesn't make any sense.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
What's going on right now? Because it's a pretty tough time to be a builder and developer, as you probably well know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's, I feel like that's an understatement. Last but not least, when you feel overwhelmed or unfocused, what do you do?
I go hit the gross grind.
Okay. That's great. And it sounds like, you were saying before we went live, it was squash with your son, but do you go by yourself or do you have a group or are you out with Chip Wilson or who are you?
I don't know. I usually just kind of go off on my own. I just like to put on, a podcast and sort of grind my way up there slowly. And some days I'm really on it. I can motor up to the top. And, some days I'm kind of reminded by my body that I'm not the 22-year-old anymore.
Fair enough. Well, thanks, James, so much for your time. And how can people find out more about what you're doing? I feel like you keep a pretty low profile, but your work speaks for itself. So maybe Gibson's Residences, do you have a plug for that or something else?
Well, it happens to be topical because it's a project that I'm doing right now. We're finishing it. Actually, we're going to finish it in February, which will be great. I've got this is actually when this project is finished, it'll be the first time in about 15 years that I don't actually have any other heritage projects in the queue. The other ones that I'm working on are mixed use projects. There's one called Woodland Block at 10th and Nanaimo that's under construction right now. That's, what is it, 82 units, mixed use project. And then a couple of other ones that are in the pipeline as well that I'm working through. And I mean, I'd love to find some more heritage projects because I find them interesting. I've learned over the years that there's a ready market for them. And they're, I'll call them intellectually stimulating.
Yeah.
But they're just, as we were talking about earlier, there just doesn't seem to be as much interest, certainly in the policy levels, in talking about these things with all the other competing interests and challenges that we have out there right now. It's related to housing. So I feel like I'm a little bit of a lonely warrior out there yelling from the rooftops, but nobody listens to me anymore.
It makes a lot of sense to me, that's for sure. And I should say Woodland Block is such a cool project too, the kind of New York inspired.
Yeah,
with the commercial space at the base, I feel like it's going to totally transform that strip. Just just south of Broadway.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's great. It's just coming out of the ground now. So the next time you walk by, you'll see big progress. It's been just a hole in the ground for the past year.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for your time, James. It was great. We'll have to have you back. Hopefully you find another project soon. You can come back on and tell us about it.
Sounds good.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with local developer and Vancouver Heritage Commission Chair, James Evans.
You know what the wild thing is? And I, again, always interesting having James on the program and getting his perspective, because it's definitely a unique one. And right now, I feel like what's going on in the city is we kind of, you know, it was like we were in this mode where it was about protecting certain sites and heritage components. We're protecting parking. We're protecting a lot of things. And now it's like been like a sweep across the board.
Throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, yeah. And now it's funny, but a lot of people that were supporting a pretty dramatic change now are saying, well, wait a second. This is maybe going too far. It's like a different thing emerging from like the usual groups that existed before, right? Kind of like the NIMBY
That's exactly
like it's a more nuanced groups are emerging, right?
So, and I think James actually had a lot of interesting things to say about that, because I put it to him. Basically, these are the tried and true methods of NIMBYs in a lot of ways, yeah. Right? But his take, I liked it. It was great. And man, he's a smart guy. And man, is he building nice stuff all throughout Grandview Woodlands. That is for sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Matt, what else do we have before we cut for the day?
What else do we have? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for things like the Livewire. This is our weekly mailer. It's got VIP access to pre-sale projects. It has stats, different types of stats we're sending out every month, the real estate board stats, but also sales ratios where you can dig into neighborhoods and different price bands to really get a sense of what's going on in the market. And it is an interesting moment to be monitoring that. And of course, we have tried and true private client services.
Yeah, Matt. And if you're not using PCS to monitor real estate listings in the Vancouver area, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, you get days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. You can set your own PCS account up at our site, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Just click buy with us and you will be able to monitor the market like a pro. And then on top of that, Matt, while you're there, if you are thinking of selling, we're now really firmly planted in the spring market here. It's the end of February, so we're now March. So it is the time to list. If you're thinking about listing this year, you can sign up, click sell with us and get a copy of the sold plan, which stands for start on launch date. That's S-O-L-D. So you pick the launch date when you want the listing to launch, and it gives you instructions on what needs to be done before you can push play on your listing. You can get that, a free copy of that. It's an instant download over at our site, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And Matt, if somebody wants to get in touch, how can they get in touch with you?
At any point, you can try me at 778-847-2854 or Matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we have that Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Well, have a great week, and we're back next week with another fantastic episode. I can't wait.
It's John Benest is back next
John
week.
John Benest.
This is a banger.
Oh, banger. I can't wait.
Take care.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.